given that this was the first time she'd ever been to Paris. But once they sat down, she had to admit the hot chocolate was excellent. They made it at your table, which was small and wooden, as were the old-fashioned high-backed chairs, in a blue ceramic pot using cream, chocolate powder, and sugar. The result was a cocoa so thick your spoon could stand up in it. They had croissants, too, and dunked them into the chocolate. "You know, if you want another croissant, they'll bring you one," said Sebastian, leaning back in his chair. They were the youngest people in the place by decades, Clary noticed. "You're attacking that one like a wolverine." "I'm hungry," she shrugged. "Look, if you want to talk to me, talk. Convince me." He leaned forward, his elbows on the table. She was reminded of looking into his eyes the night before, of noticing the silver ring around the iris of his eye. "I was thinking about what you said last night. I was hallucinating last night. I don't remember what I said to you." "You asked me who I belonged to," said Sebastian. Clary paused, with her cup of chocolate halfway to her mouth.
"I did?"
"Yeah." His eyes studied her face intently. "And I don't have an answer." She set her cup down, feeling suddenly, intensely uncomfortable. "You don't have to belong to anyone," she said. "It's just a figure of speech." "Well, let me ask you something now," Sebastian said. "Do you think you can forgive me? I mean, do you think forgiveness is possible for someone like me?"
"I don't know."
Clary gripped the edge of the table. "I mean, I don't know much about forgiveness as a religious concept. Just your garden variety kind of forgiving people." She took a deep breath, knowing she was babbling. It was something in the steadiness of Sebastian's dark gaze on her, as if he actually expected her to give him the answers to the questions no one else could answer. "I know you have to do things to earn forgiveness, change yourself, confess, repent, make amends." "Amends," Sebastian echoed. "To make up for what you've done." She looked down at her mug. There was no making up for the things Sebastian had done, not in any way that made sense. "Ave atque vale," Sebastian said, looking down at his mug of hot chocolate. Clary recognized the traditional words shadow hunters spoke over their dead.
"Why are you saying that? I'm not dying."
"You know, it's from a poem," he said, "by Catullus. Frater ave atque vale. Hail and farewell, my brother." He speaks of ashes, of the rites of the dead, and his own grief for his brother. "I was taught the poem young, but I didn't feel it. Either his grief, or his loss, or even the wondering what it would be like to die and to have one grieve you." He looked up at her sharply. "What do you think it would have been like if Valentine had brought you up along with me? Would you have loved me?" Clary was very glad she had put her cup down, because if she hadn't, she would have dropped it. Sebastian was looking at her not with any shyness, or the sort of natural awkwardness that might be attendant on such a bizarre question, but as if she were a curious foreign life form.
"Well," she said, "you're my brother. I would have loved you. I would have had to."
He kept looking at her with the same still, intent gaze. She wondered if she should ask him if he thought that meant he would have loved her too, like a sister. But she had a feeling he had no idea what that meant. "But Valentine didn't bring me up," she said. "In fact, I killed him." She wasn't sure why she said it. Maybe she wanted to see if it was possible to upset him. After all, Jace had told her once that he thought Valentine might have been the only thing Sebastian had ever cared about. But he didn't blanch. "Actually," he said, "the angel killed him, though it was because of you." His fingers traced patterns on the worn tabletop. "You know, when I first met you, in Idris, I had hopes. I thought you would be like me.
and when you were nothing like me, I hated you. And then, when I was brought back and Jace told me what you did, I realized that I had been wrong. You are like me.
You said that last night, Clary said. But I'm not.
You killed our father, he said. His voice was soft.
And you don't care.
Never given it a second thought, have you?
Valentine beat Jace bloody for the first 10 years of his life, and Jace still misses him, grieved for him, though they shared no blood at all.
But he was your father, and you killed him, and you've never missed a night of sleep over it.
Clary stared at him with her mouth open. It was unfair, so unfair. Valentine had never been a father to her, hadn't loved her, had been a monster who'd had to die. She had killed him because she'd had no choice.
Unbidden in her mind rose the image of Valentine, driving his blade into Jace's chest, then holding him as he died. Valentine had wept over the son he'd murdered, but she had never cried for her father, had never even considered it.
I'm right, aren't I? Said Sebastian. Tell me I'm wrong. Tell me you're not like me.
Clary stared down at the cup of chocolate, now cold. She felt like a vortex had opened up inside her head and was sucking away her thoughts and words.
I thought you thought Jace was like you, she said, finally in a choked voice. I thought that's why you wanted him with you.
I need Jace, said Sebastian. But in his heart he's not like me. You are.
He stood up. He must have paid the bill at some point. Clary couldn't remember. Come with me. He held his hand out. She stood up without taking it and retied his scarf mechanically. The chocolate she had drunk felt like acid churning in her stomach. She followed Sebastian out of the cafe and into the alley, where he stood looking up at the blue sky overhead.
I'm not like Valentine, Clary said, stopping next to him. Our mother.
Your mother, he said. Hated me. Hates me.
You saw her. She tried to kill me.
You want to tell me you take after your mother. Fine. Jocelyn Fairchild is ruthless. She always has been. She pretended to love our father for months, years maybe, so she could gather enough information on him to betray him. She engineered the uprising and watched all her husband's friends slaughtered. She stole your memories. Have you forgiven her? And when she ran from Idris, do you honestly think she ever planned to take me with her? She must have been relieved at the thought that I was dead.
She wasn't, Clary snapped. She had a box that had your baby things in it. She used to take it out and cry over it, every year on your birthday. I know you have it in your room.
Sebastian's thin, elegant lips twisted. He turned away from her and started walking down the alley.
Sebastian! Clary called after him. Sebastian, wait!
She wasn't sure why she wanted him to come back. Admittedly, she had no idea where she was or how to find her way back to the apartment, but it was more than that. She wanted to stand and fight, to prove she wasn't what he said she was. She raised her voice to a shout.
Jonathan Christopher Morgenstern!
He stopped and turned slowly, looking back over his shoulder at her. She walked toward him, and he watched her walk, his head cocked to the side, his black eyes narrow.
I bet you don't even know my middle name, she said. Adele.
There was a musicality to the way he said it, a familiarity that made her uncomfortable.
Clarissa Adele.
She reached his side.
Why Adele?
I never knew.
I don't know myself, he said. I know Valentine never wanted you to be called Clarissa Adele. He wanted you to be called Serafina, after his mother, our grandmother.
He turned around and started walking again, and this time she kept pace. After our grandfather was killed, she died. Heart attack.
Died of grief, Valentine always said.
Clary thought of Amadis, who had never gotten over her first love, Stephen. Of the Inquisitor, her whole life dedicated to revenge. Of Jace's mother, cutting her wrists when her husband died. Before I met the Nephilim, I would have said it was impossible to die of grief. Sebastian chuckled dryly.
We don't form attachments like mundanes do, he said.
Well, sometimes, surely. Not everyone is the same. But the bonds between us tend to be intense and unbreakable. That's why we do so badly with others not of our kind. Downworlders, mundanes.
My mother's marrying a downworlder, Clary said, stung.
They had paused in front of a square stone building with blue-painted shutters, almost at the end of the alley.
He was Nephilim once, said Sebastian.
And look at our father. Your mother betrayed him and left him, and he still spent the rest of his life waiting to find her again and convince her to come back to him.
That whole closet full of clothes. He shook his head.
But Valentine told Jace that love is a weakness, said Clary, that it would destroy you.
Wouldn't you think that? If you spent half your life chasing a woman even though she hated your guts because you couldn't forget about her? If you had to remember that the person you loved best in the world stabbed you in the back and twisted the knife?
He leaned in for a moment, close enough that when he spoke, his breath stirred her hair.
Maybe you are more like our mother than our father. But what difference does it make? You have ruthlessness in your bones and ice in your heart, Clarissa. Don't tell me any differently.
He spun away before she could answer him and mounted the front step of the blue-shuttered house. A strip of electric buzzers ran down the side of the wall beside the door, each with a name hand-scrawled on a placard beside it. He pressed the button beside the name Magdalena and waited. Eventually, a scratchy voice came through the speaker.
Qui est là?
Si la fils est la fille de Valentine, he said. Nous avions rendez-vous? There was a pause, and then the buzzer sounded. Sebastian yanked the door open and held it open, politely letting Clary go before him. The stairs were wooden, as worn and smooth as the side of a ship. They trudged up them in silence to the top floor, where the door was propped slightly open onto the landing. Sebastian went through first, and Clary followed. She found herself in a large, airy, light space. The walls were white, as were the curtains. Through one window, she could see the street beyond, lined with restaurants and boutiques. Cars whizzed by, but the sound of them didn't seem to penetrate inside the apartment. The floor was polished wood, the furniture white-painted wood, or upholstered couches with colorful throw pillows. A section of the apartment was set up as a sort of studio. Light poured down from a skylight onto a long wooden table. There were easels, clothes tossed over them to obscure their contents. A paint-stained smock hung from a hook on the wall. Standing by the table was a woman. Clary would have guessed her age at about Jocelyn's, if there had not been several factors obscuring her age. She wore a shapeless black smock that hid her body. Only her white hands and her face and throat were visible. On each of her cheeks was carved a thick black rune, running from the outside corner of her eye to her lips. Clary had not seen the runes before, but she could sense their meaning. Power, skill, workmanship. The woman had thick, long auburn hair, falling in waves to her waist, and her eyes, when she raised them, were a peculiar flat orange color, like a dying flame. The woman clasped her hands in front of her smock loosely. In a nervous, melodic voice, she said,
Tu dois être Jonathan Morgenstern? Et elle, c'est ta sœur? Je pense que...
I am Jonathan Morgenstern, Sebastian said. And this is my sister, yes, Clarissa. Please speak English in front of her. She doesn't understand French.
The woman cleared her throat.
My English is rusty. It has been years since I have used it.
It seems good enough to me.
Clarissa, this is Sister Magdalena of the Iron Sisters.
Clary was startled into speech.
But I thought the Iron Sisters never left their fortress.
They don't, said Sebastian, unless they are disgraced by having their part in the uprising discovered.
Who do you think armed the circle?
He smiled at Magdalena mirthlessly.
The Iron Sisters are makers, not fighters. But Magdalena fled the fortress before her part in the uprising could be discovered.
I had not seen another Nephilim in 15 years until your brother contacted me, said Magdalena.
It was hard to tell who she was looking at while she spoke. Her featureless eyes seemed to wander, but she was clearly not blind.
Is it true? Do you have the material?
Sebastian reached into a pouch hanging from his weapons belt and took from it a chunk of what looked like quartz. He set it down on the long table, and a stray shaft of sunlight passing across the skylight lit it seemingly from within.
Clary caught her breath. It was the Atomist from the junk shop in Prague.
Magdalena drew in a hissing breath.
Pure Atomus, said Sebastian.
No rune has ever touched it. The Iron Sister came around the table and laid her hands upon the Atomus. Her hands, also scarred with multiple runes, trembled.
Atomus pure, she whispered. It has been years since I touched the holy material.
It is all yours to craft with, said Sebastian. When you are done, I shall pay you in more of it. That is, if you believe you can create what I asked for.
Magdalena drew herself up. Am I not an Iron Sister? Did I not take the vows? Do my hands not shape the stuff of heaven? I can deliver what I promised, Valentine's son. Never doubt it.
Good to hear. There was a trace of humor in Sebastian's voice. I will return tonight, then. You know how to summon me if you need to.
Magdalena shook her head. All her attention was back on the glassine substance, the Atomus. She stroked it with her fingers.
Yes, you may go.
Sebastian nodded and took a step back. Clary hesitated. She wanted to seize the woman, ask her what Sebastian had demanded she do, ask her why she would ever have broken covenant law to work beside Valentine. Magdalena, as if sensing her hesitation, looked up and smiled thinly.
The two of you, she said.
And for a moment, Clary thought she was going to say that she did not understand why they were together, that she had heard that they had hated each other, that Jocelyn's daughter was a shadow hunter, while Valentine's son was a criminal. But she only shook her head.
Mon Dieu, she said, but you look just like your parents.
Chapter 16 Brothers and Sisters. When Clary and Sebastian returned to the apartment, the living room was empty, but there were dishes in the sink where there hadn't been before.
I thought you said Jace was asleep, she said to Sebastian, a note of accusation in her voice.
Sebastian shrugged. He was when I said it. There was a light mockery in his voice, but no serious unkindness. They had walked back from Magdalena's together, mostly in silence, but not a bad sort of silence. Clary had let her mind wander, only jerked back to reality on occasion by the realization that it was Sebastian she was walking beside.
I'm pretty sure I know where he is.
In his room? Clary started for the stairs.
No.
He moved in front of her. Come on, I'll show you. He headed up the stairs at a rapid pace and into the master bedroom, Clary on his heels. As she watched in puzzlement, he tapped the side of the wardrobe. It slid away, revealing a set of stairs behind it.
Sebastian cast a smirk over his shoulder at her as she came up behind him.
You're kidding, she said. Secret stairs?
Don't tell me that's the strangest thing you've seen today.
He took the stairs two at a time, and Clary, though bone-weary, followed him.
The stairs curved around and opened out into a wide room with a polished wooden floor and high walls. All manner of weapons hung from the walls, just as they did in the training room in the Institute. Kinjals and chakrams, maces and swords and daggers, crossbows and brass knuckles, throwing stars and axes and samurai swords. Training circles were neatly painted on the floor. In the center of them stood Jace, his back to the door. He was shirtless and barefoot, in black warm-up pants, a knife in each of his hands. An image flashed in her head, Sebastian's bare back, scarred, with unmistakable whip stripes. Jace's was smooth, pale gold skin over muscle, marked only with the typical scars of a shadow hunter, and the scratches her own nails had made last night. She felt herself flush, but her mind was still on the question. Why would Valentine have whipped one boy, but not the other?
Jace, she said.
He turned. He was clean. The silvery fluid was gone, and his gold hair was almost bronze dark, pasted damply to his head. His skin glistened with sweat. The expression on his face was guarded.
Where were you?
Sebastian went to the wall and began to examine the weapons there, running his bare hand along the blades. I thought Clary might want to see Paris.
You could have left me a note, Jace said.
It isn't as if our situation is the safest, Jonathan. I'd rather not have to worry about Clary.
I followed him, Clary said.
Jace turned and looked at her, and for a moment she caught a glimpse in his eyes of the boy in Idris who had shouted at her for spoiling all his careful plans to keep her safe. But this Jace was different. His hands didn't shake when he looked at her, and the pulse in his throat stayed steady.
You did what?
I followed Sebastian, she said. I was awake, and I wanted to see where he was going. She put her hands into her jeans pockets and looked at him defiantly. His eyes took her in, from her wind-mussed hair to her boots, and she felt the blood rise up in her face. Sweat shone along his collarbones and the ridges of his stomach muscles. His workout pants were folded over at the waist, showing the V of his hip bones. She remembered what it had felt like to have his arms around her, to be pressed close enough against him that she could feel every detail of his bones and muscles against her body. She felt a wave of embarrassment so acute it was dizzying. What made it worse was that Jace didn't seem in the least bit awkward, or as if the previous night had affected him as much as it had her. He seemed only annoyed. Annoyed and sweaty and hot.
Yeah, well, he said, the next time you decide to sneak out of our magically warded apartment through a door that shouldn't really exist, leave a note.
She raised her eyebrows. Are you being sarcastic?
He threw one of his knives into the air and caught it.
Possibly.
I took Clary to see Magdalena, Sebastian said.
He had taken a throwing star down from the wall and was examining it. We brought the Adamus.
Jace tossed the second knife into the air. He missed catching it this time, and it stuck point down into the floor.
You did?
I did, Sebastian said. And I told Clary the plan. I told her that we were planning to lure great demons here so we could destroy them.
But not how you plan to accomplish that, Clary said. You never told me that part.
I thought it would be better to tell you with Jace here, said Sebastian.
He snapped his wrist forward suddenly, and the throwing star flew toward Jace, who blocked it with a swift flick of his knife. It clattered to the ground. Sebastian whistled.
Fast, he commented.
Clary whirled on her brother.
You could have hurt him!
Anything that injures him injures me, said Sebastian. I was showing you how much I trust him. Now I want you to trust us. His black eyes bored into her.
Adamus, he said, the stuff I brought to the Iron Sister today. Do you know what's made out of it?
Of course, Seraph Blades, the Demon Towers of Alicante, Steely's,
and the Mortal Cup.
Clary shook her head. The Mortal Cup is gold. I've seen it.
Adamus dipped in gold.
The Mortal Sword, too, has a hilt of the stuff. They say it's the material that palaces of heaven are built from. And it isn't easy to get hold of. Only the Iron Sisters can work the stuff, and only they're supposed to have access to it.
So why did you give some to Magdalena?
So she could make a second cup, said Jace.
A second mortal cup?
Clary looked from one of them to the other, incredulous.
But you can't just do that. Just make another mortal cup.
If you could, the Clave wouldn't have panicked so much when the original mortal cup went missing. Valentine wouldn't have needed it so badly.
It's a cup, said Jace. However crafted, it will always be a cup until the angel voluntarily pours his blood into it. That's what makes it what it is.
And you think you can get Raziel to voluntarily pour his blood into a second cup for you?
Clary couldn't keep the razor edge of disbelief from her voice.
Good luck.
It's a trick, Clary, said Sebastian. You know how everything has an alliance?
Seraphic or demonic?
What the demons believe is that we want the demonic equivalent of Raziel. A demon great in power who will mix his blood with ours to create a new race of shadow hunters. Ones not bound by the law, or the covenant, or the rules of the Clave.
You told them you want to make backward shadow hunters?
Something like that. Sebastian laughed, raking fingers through his fair hair.
Jace, do you want to help me explain?
Valentine was a zealot, said Jace. He was wrong about a lot of things. He was wrong to consider killing shadow hunters. He was wrong about downworlders. But he wasn't wrong about the Clave or the Council. Every Inquisitor we've had has been corrupt. The laws handed down by the Angel are arbitrary and nonsensical, and their punishments are worse.
The law is hard, but it is the law.
How many times have you heard that? How many times have we had to duck and avoid the Clave and its laws even when we were trying to save them?
Who put me in prison? The Inquisitor. Who put Simon in prison? The Clave. Who would have let him burn?
Clary's heart had started to pound. Jace's voice, so familiar, saying these words, made her bones feel weak. He was right, and also wrong, as Valentine had been. But she wanted to believe him in a way she hadn't wanted to believe Valentine.
Fine, she said. I understand the Clave is corrupt, but I don't see what it has to do with making deals with demons.
Our mandate is to destroy demons, said Sebastian. But the Clave has been pouring all its energy into other tasks. The wards have been weakening, and more demons have been spilling into Earth. But the Clave turns a blind eye. We have opened a gate in the far north on Wrangel Island, and we will lure demons through it with the promise of this cup. Only, when they pour their blood into it, they will be destroyed. I have made deals like this with several greater demons. When Jason and I have killed them, the Clave will see we are a power to be reckoned with. They will have to listen to us.
Clary stared. Killing greater demons isn't that easy.
I did it earlier today, said Sebastian,
which is incidentally why neither of us is going to get in trouble for killing all those bodyguard demons. I killed their master.
Clary looked from Jace to Sebastian and back again. Jace's eyes were cool, interested. Sebastian's gaze was more intense. It was as if he were trying to see into her head.
Well, she said slowly, that's a lot to take in, and I don't like the idea of you putting yourselves in that kind of danger.
but I'm glad you trusted me enough to tell me.
I told you, Jay said. I told you she'd understand.
I never said she wouldn't.
Sebastian didn't take his eyes off Clary's face.
She swallowed hard. I didn't sleep much last night, she said. I need to rest.
Too bad, said Sebastian. I was going to ask if he wanted to climb the Eiffel Tower.
His eyes were dark, unreadable.
She couldn't tell if he were joking or not.
Before she could say anything in reply, Jace's hand slid into hers.
I'll go with you, he said. I didn't sleep that well myself.
He nodded at Sebastian. See you for dinner.
Sebastian made no reply.
They were nearly to the steps when Sebastian called out,
Clary!
She turned around, drawing her hand out of Jace's.
What?
My scarf.
He held out his hand for it.
Oh, right.
Taking a few steps toward him, she tugged with nervous fingers at the knotted cloth around her throat. After a moment of watching her, Sebastian made an impatient noise and stalked across the room toward her, his long legs covering the space between them quickly. She stiffened as he put his hands to her throat and deftly undid the knot with a few motions, then unwrapped the scarf.
She thought for a moment that he lingered before unwrapping it fully, his fingers brushing her throat. She remembered him kissing her on the hill by the burned remains of the Fairchild Manor, and how she had felt as if she were falling into a dark and abandoned place, lost and terrified. She backed up hastily, and the scarf fell away from her neck as she turned.
Thanks for lending it to me, she said, and darted back to follow Jace down the stairs, not looking behind to see her brother watch her go, holding the scarf, a quizzical expression on his face.
Simon stood among the dead leaves and looked up the path. Once more the human impulse to take a deep breath came on him. He was in Central Park, near the Shakespeare Garden. The trees had lost the last of their autumn luster, the gold and green and red turning to brown and black. Most of the branches were bare. He touched the ring on his finger again.
Clary?
Again there was no reply. His muscles felt as tense as strung wires. It had been too long since he had been able to raise her using the ring. He told himself over and over that she could be sleeping, but nothing could untie the terrible knot of tension in his stomach. The ring was his only connection to her, and right now it felt like nothing more than a hunk of dead metal. He dropped his hands to his sides and moved forward, up the path, past the statues and the benches inscribed with verses from Shakespeare's plays. The path turned to a curving right, and suddenly he could see her, sitting up, a head on a bench, looking away from him, her dark hair in a long braid down her back. She was very still, waiting, waiting for him. Simon straightened his back and walked toward her, even though every step felt as if it was weighted with lead. She heard him as he approached and turned around, her pale face going even paler as he sat down beside her.
Simon, she said on an exhale of breath, I wasn't sure you'd come.
Hi, Rebecca, he said. She held out her hand and he took it, silently thanking the forethought that had made him put on gloves that morning so that if he touched her she wouldn't feel the chill of his skin. It hadn't been that long since he'd seen her last, maybe 4 months, but already she seemed like the photograph of someone he'd known a long time ago, even though everything about her was familiar. Her dark hair, her brown eyes, the same shape and color as his own, the spatter of freckles across her nose. She wore jeans, a bright yellow parka, and a green scarf with big yellow cotton flowers. Clary called Becky's style hippie chic. About half her clothes came from vintage stores, and the other half she sewed herself. As he squeezed her hand, her dark eyes filled with tears.
Simon,
she said, and put her arms around him and hugged him. He let her, patting her arms, her back, clumsily,
When she pulled back, wiping at her eyes, she frowned.
God, your face is cold, she said.
You should wear a scarf. She looked at him accusingly. Anyway, where have you been?
I told you, he said.
I was staying with a friend. She gave a short bark of laughter. Okay, Simon, that so doesn't cut it, she said.
What the hell is going on?
Bex. I called home about Thanksgiving, Rebecca said, staring straight ahead at the trees. You know, what train I should take, that sort of thing. And you know what Mom said? She said not to come home. There wasn't going to be any Thanksgiving. So I called you. You didn't pick up. I called Mom to find out where you were. She hung up on me. Just hung up on me. So I came home. That's when I saw the religious weirdness all over the door. I freaked out on Mom, and she told me you were dead. Dead. My own brother. She said you were dead, and a monster took your place.
What did you do?
I got the hell out of there, said Rebecca. Simon could tell she was trying to sound tough, but there was a thin, frightened edge to her voice. It was pretty clear Mom had lost it.
Oh, Simon said.
Rebecca and his mother had always shared a fraught relationship. Rebecca liked to refer to his mother as nuts or the crazy lady, but it was the first time he'd had the sense she really meant it.
Damn right, oh, Rebecca snapped.
I was frantic. I texted you every 5 minutes. Finally, I get that crap text about you staying with a friend. Now you want to meet me here.
What the hell, Simon? How long has this been going on?
How long has what been going on?
What do you think? Mom being totally mental.
Rebecca's small fingers picked at her scarf. We have to do something. Talk to someone. Doctors. Get her on meds or something. I didn't know what to do. Not without you. You're my brother.
I can't, Simon said.
I mean, I can't help you. Her voice softened. I know it sucks, and you're just in high school. But, Simon, we have to make these decisions together.
I mean, I can't help you get her on meds, he said. Or take her to the doctor.
Because she's right. I am a monster. Rebecca's mouth dropped open.
Has she brainwashed you?
No. Her voice wobbled. You know, I thought maybe she'd hurt you, the way she was talking. But then I thought, no, she'd never do that, no matter what. But if she did, if she laid a finger on you, Simon, so help me!
Simon couldn't take it anymore. He stripped off his glove and held his hand out to his sister.
His sister, who'd held his hand on the beach when he was too small to toddle into the ocean unassisted. Who'd mopped blood off him after soccer practice, and tears off him after their father had died, and their mother was a zombie, lying in her room staring at the ceiling. Who'd read to him in his race car-shaped bed when he still wore footy pajamas.
I am the Lorax. I speak for the trees.
Who once accidentally shrunk all his clothes in the wash so they were doll size when she was trying to be domestic. Who packed his lunch when their mother didn't have time.
Rebecca, he thought.
The last tie he had to cut. Take my hand, he said. She took it and winced.
You're so cold. Have you been sick?
You could say that. He looked at her, willing her to sense something wrong with him, really wrong, but she only looked back at him with trusting brown eyes. He bit back a flare of impatience.
It wasn't her fault. She didn't know.
Take my pulse, he said.
I don't know how to take someone's pulse, Simon. I'm an art history major.
He reached over and moved her fingers up to his wrist.
Press down. Do you feel anything?
For a moment, she was still, her bangs swinging over her forehead.
No. Am I supposed to? Becky.
He pulled his wrist back in frustration. There was nothing else for it. There was only one way. "Look at me," he said. And when her eyes swung up to his face, he let his fangs snap out. She screamed. She screamed and fell off the bench onto the hard-packed dirt and leaves. Several passers-by looked at them curiously, but it was New York, and they didn't stop or stare, just kept moving. Simon felt wretched. This was what he'd wanted. But it was different, actually looking at her crouching there, so pale that her freckles stood out like ink blots, her hands over her mouth, just like it had been with his mother. He remembered telling Clary there was no worse feeling than not trusting the people you loved. He'd been wrong. Having the people you loved be afraid of you was worse. "Rebecca," he said, and his voice broke. "Becky." She shook her head, her hand still over her mouth. She was sitting in the dirt, her scarf trailing in the leaves. Under other circumstances, it might have been funny. Simon got down off the bench and knelt down next to her. His fangs were gone, but she was looking at him as if they were still there. Very hesitantly, he reached out and touched her on the shoulder. "Bex," he said, "I would never hurt you. I would never hurt Mom either. I just wanted to see you one last time to tell you I'm going away and you won't need to see me again. I'll leave you both alone. You can have Thanksgiving. I won't show up. I won't try to stay in touch. I won't..." "Simon." She grabbed his arm, and then she was pulling him toward her like a fish on a line. He half fell against her and she hugged him, her arms around him, and the last time she'd hugged him like this was the day of their father's funeral, when he'd cried in that way one cried when it didn't seem like it was ever going to stop. "I don't want to never see you again." "Oh," Simon said. He sat back in the dirt, so surprised that his mind had gone blank. Rebecca put her arms around him again, and he let himself lean against her, even though she was slighter than he was. She had held him up when they'd been children, and she could do it again. "I thought you wouldn't." "Why?" she said. "I'm a vampire," he said. It was weird, hearing it like that, out loud. "So there are vampires?" "And werewolves, and other weirder stuff. This just happened. I mean, I got attacked. I didn't choose it. But it doesn't matter. This is me now." "Do you..." Rebecca hesitated, and Simon sensed that this was the big question, the one that really mattered. "Bite people?" He thought about Isabel, then pushed the mental image hastily away. "And I bit a 13-year-old girl. And a dude. It's not as weird as it sounds." "No. Some things were not his sister's business. I drink blood out of bottles. Animal blood. I don't hurt people." "Okay." She took a deep breath. "Okay. Is it? Okay, I mean?" "Yeah. I love you," she said. She rubbed his back awkwardly. He felt something damp on his hand and looked down. She was crying. One of her tears splashed onto his fingers, another one followed, and he closed his hand around it. He was shivering, but not from cold. Still, she pulled off her scarf and wrapped it around them both. "We'll figure it out," she said. "You're my little brother, you dumb idiot. I love you no matter what." They sat together, shoulder to shoulder, looking off into the shadowy spaces between the trees. It was bright in Jace's bedroom, midday sunlight pouring through the open windows. The moment Clary walked in, the heels of her boots clicked on the hardwood floor. Jace closed the door and locked it behind her. There was a clatter as he dropped the knives onto his bedside table. She began to turn, to ask him if he was all right, when he caught her around the waist and pulled her against him.
The boots gave her extra height, but he still had to bend down to kiss her. His hands on her waist lifted her up and against him. A second later, his mouth was on hers, and she forgot all issues of height and awkwardness. He tasted like salt and fire. She tried to shut out everything but sensation, the familiar smell of his skin and sweat, the chill of his damp hair against her cheek, the shape of his shoulders and back under her hands, the way her body fit to his. He pulled her sweater over her head. Her t-shirt was short-sleeved, and she felt the heat coming off him against her skin. His lips parted hers, and she felt herself coming apart as his hand slid down to the top button on her jeans. It took all self-control she had to catch at his wrist with her hand and hold it still. "Jace," she said, "don't." He drew away, enough for her to see his face. His eyes were glassy, unfocused. His heart pounded against hers. "Why?" She squeezed her eyes shut. "Last night, if I hadn't fainted, then I don't know what would have happened, and we were in the middle of a room full of people. Do you really think I want my first time with you, or any time with you, to be in front of a bunch of strangers?" "That wasn't our fault," he said, pushing his fingers softly through her hair. The scarred palm of his hand scratched her cheek lightly. "That silver stuff was fairy drugs. I told you. We were high. But I'm sober now, and you're sober now. And Sebastian's upstairs, and I'm exhausted, and this would be a terrible, terrible idea that both of us would regret. And I don't feel like it," she lied. "You don't feel like it?" Disbelief colored his voice. "I'm sorry if no one's ever said that to you before, Jace, but no, I don't feel like it." She looked pointedly down at his hand, still at the waistband of her jeans. "And now I feel like it even less." He raised both eyebrows, but instead of saying anything, he simply let go of her. "Jace, I'm going to take a cold shower," he said, backing away from her. His face was blank, unreadable. When the bathroom door slammed shut behind him, she walked over to the bed, neatly made up, no residual silver on the coverlet, and sank down, putting her head in her hands. It wasn't as if she and Jace never fought. She'd always thought they argued about as much as normal couples did, usually good-naturedly, and they'd never been angry with each other in any significant way. But there was something about the coldness at the back of this Jace's eyes that shook her, something far off and unreachable that made it harder than ever to push away the question always at the back of her mind. Is any of the real Jace still in there? Is there anything left to save? Now this is the law of the jungle, as old and as true as the sky. And the wolf that shall keep it may prosper, but the wolf that shall break it must die. As the creeper that girdles the tree trunk, the law runneth forward and back. For the strength of the pack is the wolf, and the strength of the wolf is the pack. Jordan stared blindly at the poem tacked to the wall of his bedroom. It was an old print that he'd found in a used bookstore, the words surrounded by an elaborate border of leaves. The poem was by Rudyard Kipling, and it so neatly encapsulated the rules by which werewolves lived, the law that bound their actions, that he wondered if Kipling hadn't been a downworlder himself, or at least known about the Accords. Jordan had felt compelled to buy the print and stick it up on his wall, though he'd never been one for poetry. He'd been pacing his apartment for the last hour, sometimes taking his phone out to see if Maya had texted, in between bouts of opening the refrigerator and staring into it to see if anything worth eating had appeared. It hadn't. But he didn't want to go out and get food in case she came to the apartment while he was out. He also took a shower, cleaned up the kitchen, tried to watch TV, and failed,
and started the process of organizing all his DVDs by color. He was restless. Restless in the way he sometimes got before the full moon, knowing the change was coming, feeling the pull of the tides in his blood. But the moon was waning, not waxing, and it wasn't the change making him feel like crawling out of his skin. It was Maya. It was being without her, after almost 2 solid days in her company, never more than a few feet away from her. She'd gone without him to the police station, saying that now wasn't the time to upset the pack with a non-member, even though Luke was healing. There was no need for Jordan to come, she'd argued, since all she had to do was ask Luke if it was all right for Simon and Magnus to visit the farm tomorrow, and then she'd call up to the farm and warn any of the pack who might be staying up there to clear off the property. She was right, Jordan knew. There was no reason for him to go with her, but the moment she was gone, the restlessness kicked up inside him. Was she leaving because she was sick of being with him? Had she rethought and decided she'd been right about him before? And what was going on between them? Were they dating? Maybe you should have asked her before you slept together, genius, he told himself, and realized he was standing in front of the refrigerator again. Its contents hadn't changed. Bottles of blood, a defrosted pound of ground beef, and a dented apple. The key turned in the front door lock, and he jumped away from the refrigerator, spinning around. He looked down at himself. He was barefoot, in jeans and an old t-shirt. Why hadn't he taken the time while she'd been away to shave, look better, put on some cologne or something? He ran his hands quickly through his hair as Maya came into the living room, dropping his spare set of keys onto the coffee table. She had changed clothes into a soft pink sweater and jeans. Her cheeks were pink from the cold, her lips red, and her eyes bright. He wanted to kiss her so badly it hurt. Instead, he swallowed. So, how'd it go? Fine. Magnus can use the farm. I already texted him. She strolled over to him and leaned her elbows on the counter. I also told Luke what Raphael said about Maureen. I hope that's okay. Jordan was puzzled. Why do you think he needed to know? She seemed to deflate. Oh, God, don't tell me I was supposed to keep it a secret. No, I was just wondering. Well, if there really is a rogue vampire cutting her way through Lower Manhattan, the pack should know. It's their territory. Besides, I wanted his advice about whether we should tell Simon or not. What about my advice? He was playing at sounding hurt, but there was a little part of him that meant it. They'd discussed it before, whether Jordan should tell his assignment that Maureen was out there and killing, or whether it would just be another burden to add to everything Simon was dealing with now. Jordan had come down on the side of not telling him. What could he do about it anyway? But Maya hadn't been so sure. She jumped up on top of the counter and swung around to face him. Even sitting down, she was taller than him this way, her brown eyes sparkling down into his. I wanted grown-up advice. He grabbed hold of her swinging legs and ran his hands up the seams of her jeans. I'm 18. Not grown-up enough for you? She put her hands on his shoulders and flexed them, as if testing his muscles. Well, you've definitely grown. He pulled her down from the counter, catching her around the waist and kissing her. Fire sizzled up and down his veins as she kissed him back, her body melting against his. He slid his hands up into her hair, knocking her knitted cap off and letting her curls spring free. He kissed her neck as she pulled his shirt up over his head and ran her hands all over him, shoulders, back, arms, purring in her throat like a cat. He felt like a helium balloon, high from kissing her, and light with relief. So she wasn't done with him after all. Jordy, she said. Wait. She almost never called him that, unless it was serious. His heartbeat, already wild, speeded up further. What's wrong? It's just, if every time we see each other we fall into bed, and I know I started it, I'm not blaming you or anything.
It's just that maybe we should talk.
He stared at her big dark eyes, the fluttery pulse in her throat, the flush on her cheeks. With an effort, he spoke evenly.
Okay, what do you want to talk about?
She just looked at him. After a moment, she shook her head and said, Nothing. She locked her hands behind his head and pulled him close, kissing him hard, fitting her body against his.
Nothing at all.
Clary didn't know how long it was before Jace came out of the bathroom, toweling off his wet hair. She looked up at him from where she was still sitting on the edge of the bed. He was sliding a blue cotton t-shirt on over smooth golden skin marked with white scars. She darted her eyes away as he came across the room and sat down next to her on the bed, smelling strongly of soap.
I'm sorry, he said.
Now she did look at him, in surprise. She had wondered if he was capable of being sorry in his current state. His expression was grave, a little curious, but not insincere.
Wow, she said. That cold shower must have been brutal.
His lips quirked up at the side, but his expression grew serious again almost immediately. He put his hand under her chin.
I shouldn't have pushed you. It's just 10 weeks ago, just holding each other would have been unthinkable.
I know. He cupped her face in his hands, his long fingers cool against her cheeks, tilting her face up. He was looking down at her, and everything about him was so familiar. The pale gold irises of his eyes, the scar on his cheek, the full lower lip, the slight chip in his tooth that saved his looks from being so perfect that they were annoying. And yet somehow, it was like coming back to a house she had lived in as a child. And knowing that though the exterior might look the same, a different family lived there now.
I never cared, he said. I wanted you anyway. I always wanted you. Nothing mattered to me but you. Not ever.
Clary swallowed. Her stomach fluttered. Not just with the usual butterflies she felt around Jace, but with real uneasiness.
But Jace... That's not true. You cared about your family. And I always thought you were proud of being Nephilim, one of the angels.
Proud? He said. To be half angel, half human, you're always conscious of your own inadequacy. You're not an angel. You're not beloved of heaven. Raziel doesn't care about us. We can't even pray to him. We pray to nothing. We pray for nothing. Remember when I told you I thought I had demon blood, because it explained why I felt the way I did about you? It was a relief in a way, thinking that. I've never been an angel, never even close. Well, he added, maybe the fallen kind.
Fallen angels are demons.
I don't want to be Nephilim, said Jace. I want to be something else, stronger, faster, better than human, but different. Not subservient to the laws of an angel who couldn't care less about us. Free. He ran his hand through a curl of her hair. I'm happy now, Clary. Doesn't that make a difference?
I thought we were happy together, Clary said.
I've always been happy with you, he said. But I never thought I deserved it.
And now you do?
And now that feeling's gone, he said. All I know is that I love you, and for the first time, that's good enough. She closed her eyes. A moment later, he was kissing her again. Very softly this time, his mouth tracing the shape of hers. She felt herself go pliant under his hands. She sensed it as his breathing quickened and her own pulse jumped. His hands stroked down through her hair, over her back, to her waist. His touch was comforting, the feel of his heartbeat against hers like familiar music, and if the key was slightly different, with her eyes closed, she couldn't tell. Their blood was the same, under the skin, she thought,
as the Seelie Queen had said. Her heart raced when his did, had nearly stopped when his had. If she had to do it all again, she thought, under the pitiless gaze